Welcome to this special Valentine's Day edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. First up on today's show, we'll hear about the secrets of maintaining a healthy, flirty, love-filled, long-term relationship. Psychotherapist and relationship counselor Esther Perel joined me last year to discuss her book, Mating in Captivity, Unlocking Erotic Excellence. It provides readers with advice on sustaining sexual excitement in a romantic partnership. Her book debunks many myths surrounding both the male and female libidos and sheds light on some of the hang-ups and rituals that often mar sexual encounters with our significant others. Let's give it a listen. Do you think marriage or long-term committed relationships is harmful to desire?
Look, for most of history, desire had very little to do with marriage. We married for economic reasons. We married for companionship, economic support, children, social respectability. Then we brought love to marriage. Then we brought sexuality to love. Then we brought happiness down from the heaven, and it no longer is a privilege of the afterlife. It is a mandate that we need to accomplish. And then we linked marital happiness with sexual satisfaction. So we have revolutionized marriage when it comes to sexuality. This is the first time in the history of humankind that we don't just have marital sex for procreation because we want 10 children. It is the first time in the West where sexuality is not a marital duty of women. And it is all rooted in desire. Mm. It is connected to the individualism of our society in which we own the wanting, that's the definition of desire, and in which we want to have an erotic connection for pleasure and intimacy with a partner just because we feel like it. So how do we sustain desire in long-term relationships is a first. It is not a question that we have asked for most of the history of marriage. And then what happens is that we're trying to reconcile within marriage, to reconcile love and desire, to reconcile intimacy and sexuality. It's about bringing together two sets of fundamental human needs, our need for security and safety and predictability, and our equally strong need for passion and novelty and mystery and the unknown. And those two needs actually pull us in different directions and spring from different sources. But we are for the first time wanting to experience with the same partner anchor and waves, comfort and edge, security and excitement, predictability and surprise. And we take it for granted that this is a model that should be in the reach of all. Mm. And yet it is the grand experiment that we are in at this time.
But it's really asking two different things, as you say, with the sense of love and commitment comes closeness. But you say that desire needs a kind of distance. So it's this very sort of strange, almost like tension or dance between these two, what feel like poles.
Absolutely. You have the word. It's a dance. It's a careful calibration, it's a dialectic, it's not an opposition. But if we would say that love is about having, we could say that desire is about wanting. If love seeks closeness, desire needs a certain emotional and psychological space to thrive. If love wants to close the gap, desire is about opening that gap again and bringing it back to life. And when I ask people, when do you find yourself most drawn to your partner, not just sexually attracted, but drawn to in the broad sense, worldwide, mating in captivity is translated in 25 languages.
Yeah, I noticed that. Yeah.
Been around, and it's extraordinary how the same answers are provided all the time. Number one is when I see my partner passionate about something, in their element, doing something they really like, radiant, playful, confident. It can be on ski, on surf, on stage with the kids, but it is when they are in their element and I'm looking at my partner from a certain distance, a comfortable distance, not too far because then I can't see them anymore, and not too close because then I can't see them either. Hmm. But at a comfortable distance that allows you to see the otherness, the uniqueness of your partner, who after all these years still remains somewhat mysterious, somewhat unknown, a person with whom you can still, about whom you can still discover something. So people in their answer are de facto speaking about that need for an emotional distance. Between me and the other lies the erotic elan, lies the ability for the movement of desire that wants to reach out to someone and bring them closer to us or go toward them. And then they talk about surprise. They talk about novelty. They talk about, even when they say, when I see my partner vulnerable, it's because that's the part of their partner that they don't typically see. It's when I get a glimpse at something that isn't available to me on a daily basis. It's when we laugh, when we play, when we are carefree and unself-conscious, which is also on the side of desire. And these various answers imply that if closeness is part of love, desire needs a certain space to thrive. It needs otherness. It needs difference. It needs a bridge to cross with somebody to visit on the other side.
But I think that's so different from the way I think many people believe or feel, which is that if you know someone and they know you so intimately and you feel so safe, then that can be a place for this erotic desire or these erotic fantasies. But you're saying something really different from that.
It is true for many people, what you describe. For many people, love and desire are inseparable and inextricably related. But for others, they are also much more separate. My book started because people would come into my office. I'm a practicing couples therapist for 30 years. I'm actually doing a whole webinar now for this very question. We love each other very much. We have no sex, they would say. I know he loves me dearly. It's been years since I felt wanted. And they knew the difference. Love and desire, they relate, but they also sometimes conflict. To write about people who can't stand each other and don't want to touch each other wouldn't have been particularly interesting. What was interesting is, why is it that so often sex degrades, even in couples who continue to love each other as much as ever? Why does good intimacy not guarantee good sex? Why is the forbidden so erotic? Why is it that when I want and I can't, I want it more than when I want and it almost becomes what I should? So I began to look at what is it in the making of family that sometimes stifles desire, that sometimes the very elements that nurture love, protection, a feeling of responsibility toward the other, feeling of worry toward the well-being of the other, sense of mutuality, reciprocity, that all those elements that are so core to love are sometimes, paradoxically, the very ones that stifle desire, which is much more on the side of the unself-conscious, on the side of carefree. Responsibility and worry are completely anti-aphrodisiac. In the description of when I see my partner radiant, self-sufficient, doing his or her thing, you never have caretaking. It's a very powerful thing. Caretaking is really loving, but it sometimes is very much unerotic. There is something about that freedom of seeing my partner in his or her orbit, you know, without needing me, that allows me to then feel that I want them or that they can want me. It is the real switch between I need you versus I want you that is often at the core of where desire resides. I don't ask people how much the sex they have, because people have had sex for centuries, especially women, and felt nothing.
Well, does that also help explain why people have affairs, whether even having an affair is sort of falling in love with yourself in a way?
There are loads of reasons why people stray. The majority of people I see are not repeat offenders. They're not philanderers. They are often people who have been faithful for decades and who one day cross a line that they never thought they would cross. And so one wonders, for a glimmer of what? Why would people risk losing their kids, their family, their house, their money, you know, for what? And women even more so. And then I began to think, to listen to hundreds of people that I see and interview and work with telling me that it is not about sex. That is the big misunderstanding. It is about attention. It is about care. It is about feeling special and important and that we matter again. It is about reconnecting with lost parts of ourselves And that often when we go elsewhere, it's not just that we want to leave the person that we are with as much as we want to leave who we have ourselves become.
Mm.
And there is longing for that reconnecting with a lost self that is often a part of the experience of an affair. But it is a piece of this that is often overlooked, that people feel that they are alive. I mean, that is the word that I would say worldwide I am hearing when I interview people about infidelity. People feel alive. You know, the same children are there as were there yesterday, but they managed to get energy to cross town and show up at 6 o'clock in the morning on the other side of town because I have to have it. I'm energized again. It's an ultimate experience of eroticism, I would say it like that. And that has very little to do with sex. There may be emotional infidelities, and they will have that same kind of energy of once again feeling important and engaged.
Do you, Esther Perel, make a differentiation between men and desire and women desire?
There are plenty of differences and a lot more similarities. I think that the men have had throughout history the permission to pursue their erotic needs a lot more than women. And women, throughout history until today, have often put their security needs above their erotic needs. But that doesn't mean that they experience sexuality fundamentally that different of men. What is different is that they are often more willing to forego the whole thing. So it looks that women have less of a need in sex and women are less interested in sex in relationships. And I often think maybe they're not so much less interested in sex, but they're less interested in the sex that they're going to have.
Mm.
In order to want it, it needs to be worth wanting, and they don't always find that it's going to be worthy enough. It's not a good enough experience. So if I'm tired, I may just as well go to sleep. On the one other hand, I would say female sexuality is a lot more subjective. It is full-bodied, and in that sense, it is much more contextual. She can lose it much sooner, but she actually also can reconnect with it much easier because it is all over her body and much more diffuse and related to her relationship and her feeling about herself. Ask every woman first about her own phylogenia. Would she make love with herself? If she does not like herself, if she does not like her body, if she does not want to stay inside her body, why would she invite anybody to come in there? On the other hand, I think that we often oversimplify male sexuality and think of it as a biological creature that is in perpetual motion just looking for an outlet. And I think that men, no less than women, are driven internally. Their sense of self-esteem, their sense of depression, their sense of anxiety, their feelings about their accomplishments at work, their fear of rejection, their need for competency, their doubts about her pleasure, all of these are internal experiences that men have that also influence their sexuality.
That was psychotherapist and relationship counselor Esther Perel, who joined me last year to discuss her book, Mating in Captivity, Unlocking Erotic Excellence. You're listening to the Valentine's Day edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. When we get back, we'll hear a portion of my 2011 conversation with writer Diane Ackerman about her book, 100 Words for Love. Stay with us. This is the Valentine's Day edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Next, we turn to my conversation with poet, essayist, and author Diane Ackerman. She joined me in the studio in 2011 to discuss her memoir, 100 Words for Love. The book recounts her experience caring for her husband after he had a stroke. His ailment severely affected the speech areas of his brain, causing the couple to start inventing their own language. It's a powerful account of the healing power of real love and the power of having a strong, meaningful bond with a significant other. Here's my interview.
He was actually sick in the hospital, and you came back from a book tour to be with him. He had an infection.
He did. He had a bladder infection, and I happened just coincidentally to be on tour with a book about the brain. So I knew in chilling detail what had happened to him. I was the best person, I suppose, but certainly the worst person, too, to have a spouse who'd had a stroke.
He was in the hospital for a couple of weeks with this infection.
Yes.
And then literally He has a stroke.
He had a stroke. And he had had a transient stroke some years before, and I knew all the symptoms. I knew exactly what had happened. What I didn't know is if he would also recover quickly mm-hmm. from this, or if this affliction would be with him.
And what did that stroke look like to you when you saw it?
His eyes were glazed. His mouth had fallen like mud. And he looked at me with eyes that were not expressive, but they were full of alarm. So he wasn't squinting them or anything, but I could just read the alarm in his eyes. And I said to him, "Are you having a stroke?" And he just looked at me.
He couldn't say anything.
He couldn't say a word. He had the worst possible kind of stroke. Sometimes people get one kind where they can't speak well, but they understand what people are saying. And in the cruelest of ironies for the author of nearly 50 books and for his word-obsessed wife, he had a stroke that mainly hit the language areas of his brain. And he could no longer understand anything anyone said to him. But he also couldn't read, write, read clocks, do math.
Or swallow
food.
And your husband is able to recover some of this language. He also begins to write. So we not only see and learn about your experiences of his stroke, but his experience of having a stroke, which seems to me an extraordinary thing to learn.
Very, very rare. Because by definition, somebody who has global aphasia can't tell you. And so I was able to find out a lot of what goes on in the mind of somebody who's having a stroke. And I discovered, for example, that they continue to have that dialogue that we have with ourselves. He heard speaking. It's just that because his brain was all miswired, he couldn't give the signal to his mouth to express it. And in time, when he began to get back just a couple of words, words would tumble out that he didn't want to. Hmm. And that's often what happens, that somebody who's had a stroke can only say what the mouth can utter, not what they mean. And it can sound very confusing, but, you know, it can also sound very funny, and you can really enjoy it.
Well, you just in that description is all the sort of noise, the clanking in his head.
Yes, he said that he actually felt his teeth blink at the time.
Now, what do you think he meant by that?
I have no idea. I think his mouth felt very strange, the sensations, the nerves, yes.
He also writes, and this is when he begins to write, "On rare occasions, the word I sought lay like an angel begging to be used." And the idea that, you know, the word is over there, right?
Yes.
You just can't get to it.
Yes, it was horribly frustrating for him. And my challenge, among other things, among trying to keep together what had been a very long, sentimental, romantic, kissy love affair, was also to help him get back as much language as possible. And I discovered very quickly that all of the normal speech therapy that was taking place with him, because we went through five different therapists, really was just not right for someone like Paul, who was way too imaginative. But I think it was perhaps too rigid, too textbook, to work best maybe for anyone. It really was designed only for people with acute problems. And as I know from being a teacher, there are two ways to teach anything. You can teach from the lesson book, or you can figure out how the student needs to learn. And that takes a lot more work, but to individualize it like that is so much more effective.
And I'm wondering, with a more traditional therapy would, and I'm holding up a pen in front of you, so someone would say to your husband, "This is a pen," and try to get him to say the word pen?
Yes. Exactly. But I was walking through our little home library one day when a therapist was showing him a photograph of a telephone on a table. And she pointed to the table and she said, "What's this?" And he said, "Skylargle." And she said, "No, that's nonsense. It's a table." "What's this?" And she pointed to the telephone and he said, "Tesseract." And she said, "No, that's nonsense." But at that moment, really the trajectory of our lives changed because something dawned on me. And I turned around and went back in and said, you know, actually, a tesseract is a real word. It's a three-dimensional object unfolded into the fourth dimension, and in a funny way, that's what a telephone does. And I began to realize that, okay, the words that we learn as children are processed in the language areas of the brain.
Here's a pen, right?
Exactly. You know, that's mother. There's the sky. But it was possible that words that we learn as adults, maybe in hobbies or specialties, get processed elsewhere like a foreign language. And at that point, I just took over his therapy and started to work with him through that new vocabulary.
I mean, I think couples that love each other and spend time together create a language
they
for
do.
Each other.
I think love is essentially a cult of two with fallible gods and has its
a
own.
A folie à deux, don't you think?
Yes, and has its own special rituals and lingo and everything. So there are other ways, and always the hobbies, the interests. There are different ways to do this.
And he had, before his stroke, had all sorts of pet names for you, I guess.
Yes.
Endearing, loving names for
well,
you.
Well, he used to make up little operettas about me in the course of the day. He would just improvise because we always were very playful. And if you're word people, of course, you play with words. And yes, and he lamented that he couldn't remember even one. He seemed so sad. And I was sad that he seemed to have lost his ability to describe things in images. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, why don't you make up some new ones? And so casting about, he let the aphasia tumble out a little bit, just enough, and he had the thrill of being able to control it a little bit and whip out one a day for 100 days in a row.
Well, and, it's hard for me to pick my favorite here. Are there some ones that you just resonate with in particular?
Yes, I like a fleet-footed empress of sleep, rheostat of sentimental dreaming, my little celestial porcupine. Now, this one is strange, my billiard table of the decaying gods. Where did that come from?
I circled that one because that seems so strangely delightful.
But how about dark-eyed Junko, my little bunko?
Yeah.
Or O singing squirrel of the Antipodes? And then maybe my favorite, because it just sounds like Whitman, I think,
yeah.
O parakeet of the Lissom Star.
Wow. And right before that, little flavonoid wonder.
Oh, I love that one, too. and Bobby Dazzler of the Golden Morn. He means the British bobbies, the policemen.
But do you think, and this was every day, so he was, you gave him permission to just let the words come out.
Exactly.
Don't worry what they mean. Don't worry if they make sense together.
Yes, and this was really one of the strategies that I used, too, was circumlocution. Say, in order to communicate, use anything that you can. And even if you need to do it in a roundabout way, let your brain hunt and do it, because what comes out can be very funny, and it's nice if you make people laugh. For example, we had ants in the kitchen, and he couldn't find the word ants, so he called them a cache of creepy crawlies. But I knew what he meant.
Let me just go back to when your husband was beginning to utter sounds, and one of the words you come in, and one of the words he says to you is mim.
Mem was all he could say, and this happens so often. For example, in the case of the poet Baudelaire, when he had a stroke, all he could say was goddamn. And that was especially awkward because he was being taken care of by nuns.
Oh, wow.
Very bad. They thought he was blaspheming all day. Some people can only say yes or can only say chicken or whatever. He was left with this one syllable. But early on, I decided that I should just try to drench him in language. And to that end, among other things, I hired the most wonderful, cute, young nursing student named Liz, who came over, and her job was partly to swim with him for a couple of hours. She was a self-described chatterbox, so she was to talk with him nonstop. And from morning to night, he was surrounded by language.
Mm-hmm.
I think that in his case, that was very important. But I also made up frisky little Mad Libs for him to do. And we just had to find new ways to play. It isn't just a question of people who have a stroke. When any kind of crisis happens in a marriage, the first thing that goes is laughter and play. And I feel very strongly, having been married now for 41 years, that if you're married any length of time, it's not one marriage, it's several marriages, because things happen to you and you change. Mm. And if you are going to thrive as a couple and continue on and not get divorced, you have to be able to embrace those changes and you have to find ways to continue having fun.
And Mim, I guess, meant many things. I guess he could say it in many different ways, but that was, I guess, the beginning of this.
That he could utter sound
at
all.
Could say sound at all.
Yes, was dramatically important. And then it became a question of what else could he say? Mm-hmm. By the time he left the hospital, he was sitting on the edge of the bed looking at me radiantly and saying, "Surprise." I said, "Yes." He said, "I talk good coffee." I said, "You talk good coffee." "Yes."
And meaning so, good English.
Exactly.
I guess, right?
And so at that point, he had a few words and home he came.
Well, you also describe, and I think anyone in your situation becomes this caregiver. And you make a very interesting distinction between a caregiver role, saying it's not a relationship. I mean, it is a relationship, but you have a role and responsibility to this person.
Because stroke hits 5 to 6 million people, and then there's everybody else out there who's faced with illness in the family or dealing with ill parents or grandparents and so on. Everybody is going to become a caregiver at some point in their life if they live long enough. That's what happens. The question is how to do it with grace and with patience and with love and with generosity. And it's not an easy thing to do. And very often caregivers beat up on themselves because they feel they're not doing enough. But the truth is that caregiving is very hard work.
Sure.
It's a full-time job. It really can't be done alone. You need to ask for help, and there are agencies around that will help you or family members. And it reduces one to a role rather than to a relationship. Normally, when you have a relationship, you play a great many roles.
Sure.
You could be sometimes a lover, a mother, you know, the prom queen, the monkey baby, whatever, the judge and jury, who knows. But in the case of caregiving, you're locked into a role. And that's very hard to get used mm-hmm. to. And you need to find ways to make it possible, not just for you, but for your loved one also.
You describe Oliver Sacks coming over. He's been a guest on the show and has written these extraordinary books about neurological conditions, even his own condition. Musicophilia was one that that we talked to him about. And he's with your husband, and they're singing.
Yes, that was wonderful. I had been to a dinner party with him the night before. When he heard that Paul had had a stroke, he thought this was so tragic. He asked if he could come pay a visit. And he wanted to show Paul that it's possible to sing things that you might not be able to say because of stuttering or stroke or whatever. Let me tell you, it's very funny to see these two guys remembering their school days in England singing Blake's Jerusalem, you know, and Happy Birthday on the couch. It was charming.
But he was able to sing, right? It was
he was able to sing.
Another part of the brain?
That's exactly what happens. And Oliver also shared with us some insight that I never forgot, and that was that regardless of what doctors and books tell you, that there is only a short window of opportunity, and whatever you don't get back in the first few months after traumatic brain injury, you're never going to have. That's just not true.
Yeah.
We know now that the brain is very, very plastic. And in a nutshell, that means don't lose hope.
Oliver Sacks is a swimmer, I know. And your husband also was
a swimmer.
Also a swimmer as well. Do you think there was something about the buoyancy, the feeling of water on the body that was...
I think so. There's, I once wrote an entire play in the bathtub.
Did you?
Yes, not all in one sitting. But there's something quite wonderful about having the rest of your senses kind of on neutral, and your brain can just function. But there's also something mystical about being outside and hearing the birds mm-hmm. and the sun sparkling on the water and all of that.
And he, this meaning your husband, was swimming with this assistant that you hired.
Yes, or with me.
Or with you. And just, what, talking and swimming and talking?
And listening and hearing the rhythms of language again and really wanting to communicate and trying and being praised for every effort and being encouraged.
And do you think also being relaxed? Because I would think there's so much focus on getting the language back that that could create a lot of tension.
Well, if people have seen the King's Speech, they know that the minute you have any kind of stress involved, then stuttering is so much harder. And so is speaking for somebody with aphasia or somebody who has performance anxiety. So if you can get rid of the stress, well, that makes it much easier.
And the fact that this assistant wore a little bikini?
It didn't hurt. Nor did it hurt that because I couldn't communicate through language well with him, I initiated early on early morning wake-up sessions of cuddling for about an hour. We would just be in bed cuddling and cuddling, and it was just so much easier for him, you know, kind of waking up dreamy to find words.
And obviously relaxed.
Very relaxed. That way. Mm-hmm. And we would laugh and we would joke. It made life just so much better in every sense.
You and your husband have often used animals as a form of endearment. Is that been a theme for you?
We have. And so when the pet names went, you know, it was suddenly as if the zoo was empty. You know, or I had said that I was a one-woman zoo because he had so many pet names for me. But I think people do this. We all have totemic names for one another. And really, there's a good discussion you could have about that and our animal origins, no matter how much we try to deny them. Obviously, we still feel very close to them.
And that was my conversation with writer Diane Ackerman, who joined me in 2011 to discuss her book, 100 Words for Love. You're listening to Radio Times in Review, and we're celebrating Valentine's Day, love, sex, and relationships. When we get back, we'll revisit my conversation about the wildly popular erotic novel, 50 Shades of Grey, as the film adaptation hits theaters today. Stay with us. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. In our last segment of today's show, we're going to listen back to my 2012 conversation about 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James. The novel, which was originally a self-published ebook, went on to sell over 100 million copies worldwide. The tale of a young girl being wooed by a billionaire with some surprising sexual preferences has been adapted for film, which debuts in theaters today. In 2012, I discussed the unlikely popularity of this story with Kinsey Institute sex researcher Debbie Herbenick and Salon.com writer Tracy Clark Flory. Let's give a listen.
This is a story about a dominant, submissive relationship. Why do you think it's found such an enthusiastic female audience?
Oh, it's a good question. You know, I think this book has certainly exposed a lot of women to the genre of erotic fiction, and it takes us out of our daily lives a little bit. I think it's a very intense and salient story of desire, first and foremost. Regardless of what they're actually doing with their sexual behaviors, I think it's about desire and wanting.
And how about for you, Tracy? Why do you think this has become such a popular book, especially among women?
Well, I think it's popular for the same fundamental reason that Twilight is so popular. As you mentioned, it's a modern remake of the classic Beauty and the Beast tale. In both cases, you have a sensitive bad boy, a monster in need of saving from his own dark desires. You know, only in the case of Shades of Grey, our hero has riding crops instead of fangs. I think that BDSM acts as an edgy update on this standard romantic trope.
But Tracy, did this book in any way shock you? Were you shocked by anything you read in this?
No. The only thing that was shocking to me was that I read it after hearing all of the hype. And I was kind of shocked by how tame it was, actually, and how slow-moving it was. I actually was expecting a bit more edginess.
Well, it's interesting you talk about the slow-moving, and I wonder whether that was, you know, 200 pages of foreplay or not.
Yeah.
There is what seems like pages and pages and pages and pages of negotiations between these two people over this relationship.
Yes, and endless email exchanges back and forth.
That was painful.
Yes.
Painful to read just because why?
It was. I also kept thinking, because I had heard it hyped so much, and so by the time I read it, I thought, well, you know, where is this going? When are they ever actually going to get together? And I did wonder, you know, how much of this is sort of intentional foreplay and the delaying of the gratification for the reader as well, and how much is it just the fact that, you know, this was originally written in ways that, you know, were supposed to kind of lure people in and online and keep them engaged in this long series.
Let me go back to you, Tracy, and I do want to talk about the characters of Christian Grey, the man in this story. He's 20-something. He's not a millionaire. He's a billionaire. Very handsome, very sexy, of course. What do you make of this particular character? As you say, this is a kind of a remake of a story that's been around for some time.
Exactly. He's her knight in shining armor. He rode up on his horse and swept her off her feet. But of course, you know, for a good story, you have to have some conflict. And so the whole, I mean, really most of the sexual tension and excitement of the book, I think, centers around their very antagonistic relationship outside of the bedroom. And that sort of power play, which is one that you see in most romantic novels, most bodice rippers. He's that classic romantic hero, you know, a modern billionaire version of that.
Debbie, your thoughts about this character?
Oh, yeah, Tracy's spot on in that regard. And when I've been at book clubs with women talking about 50 Shades of Grey, the fact that he is just this attractive billionaire, as you said, not just, you know, moderately wealthy, but as one woman said the other night, I mean, he makes $100,000 an hour, you know, and this is, you know, he's sort of like the ultimate catch to some women. And, you know, that it elevates him to this bigger status, particularly for a woman who feels insecure and who feels unattractive and who wonders if she has that value. So I think that same element, though, is what a lot of women find problematic with the book, is because there is this sense of her putting up with a lot that probably, you know, most women think women shouldn't be putting up with.
Well, I want to pick up on that. But let me ask you, I'll go back to you, Tracy, about then Anastasia Steele's a character. She's about to graduate or is graduating from college. She's a virgin. What do you make of her as a character in these kinds of stories?
Well, she's really interesting because she's such a reluctant submissive. It's not really a desire that she seems to want to pursue. Her real desire is him, and because he has these desires, she's willing to sort of entertain them, and she does sort of express that she's intrigued by this world of his, but she's also disgusted by it. And revolted by his desires, and so I think that really there that tension between the two of them, that it taps into that classic storyline of a woman trying to save or change a man.
I mean, she is disgusted in some ways, Tracy, but she's also intrigued and in many ways turned on by it too.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and I think that I think that taps into a very a shared experience, or a very common experience that people have when it comes to their own sexuality, this feeling of, you know, titillation, but also shame about what turns them on. And that tension there, I think, is something that people can very easily relate to.
Debbie, let me go back to you and this notion of the reluctant submissive. How do you understand that?
Well, you know, I think it's I teach college students at Indiana University, so I'm around, you know, many of these young women and men who are making the transition to having sex for the first time. And I think what's so interesting about that time period of life, which, of course, Anastasia is in, is that people often go very quickly in a short span of months or a year or two from thinking that a variety of behaviors are gross or perverted or in some way not what people like them do, to once they become sexually active, in whatever way that is for them, and there's so many different ways that people start having sex, to being, as you said, you know, turned on and interested. So, you know, in this case, the person who she met had these interests that we have no reason to believe she had on her own at first, but because she was so drawn to him and so desirous of him, she, you know, I think not just did them to please him, but maybe saw them through his eyes and was willing to try them out and found some of them, not everything, but found some of them to be exciting. And I think that that's a common trajectory that you see for young women and men, is this willingness to try things on, and then you learn something new about your sexual self in that way.
Debbie, would it be fair to say that erotic fantasies are not politically correct?
Often they're not. Absolutely.
And going back to you, Tracy, and in reading, both reading the book but also reading about the book, there is this question about, you know, can you be a feminist and fantasize about submission, which is, you know, in many ways what this book is looking at, this relationship between the dominant and the submissive. Do you have an answer to that question?
Oh, absolutely. You absolutely can be a feminist and fantasize about submission and even degradation, even things that, you know, were you to experience them in real life, in the real world, without consent, would be absolutely not feminist and antithetical to feminism. But I think that, for the most part, I think that young feminists, especially today, have a real respect for the world of fantasy, and the world of fantasy standing apart from the real world, and that's sort of that it's a safe place to explore unresolved issues that we have about the world that we live in. I think that, you know, inevitably you're going to sort of eroticize power imbalances that you see in the world at large. I don't think that there's anything anti-feminist about that.
Do you think, Tracy, that there are some generational differences and that younger feminists are influenced by popular culture and popular cultures, you know, always exploring things on the edges?
I don't know if it's that younger feminists are influenced by popular culture so much as I think that there is growing awareness of the places that fantasy can take us, and a respect for fantasy and it being okay to explore those things.
Debbie, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, you know, I think young feminists also, you know, the types of media that they have exposure to, there's so many great feminist blogs out there, and they do tend to be, you know, sort of narrow in focus, but that gives young women a real place to go talk and to have these conversations and learn what other women like them feel. And I think one of the topics that I see that's a common thread is really what it means to be a feminist in regard to your sexuality, and to be able to make the kinds of choices to engage in, you know, whatever variety of behaviors you want to engage in, even if they might be behaviors that, you know, shift the power imbalance in ways that to others might not seem like they're in your favor, but if you're choosing them, they're in your favor.
Let me go back to you, Debbie. Help us understand how this relationship works between, you know, the dominant and the submissive. This is the kind of heart of the book, as these two sort of negotiate this relationship. But even in the real world, what is this about?
So in the real world, you know, when there are dominant and submissive relationships, and there are differences between people who just engage in sexual behaviors with each other versus having a real, ongoing, dominant-submissive type of relationship. But what often happens is that people will make a contract with each other, as you see in the book, and you describe very clearly what's okay with you and what's not okay with you, because once you're actually in what you would call the scene, so you're actually sort of, you know, acting something out and participating in the types of behaviors together, you know, part of the play is that you might say things like no, no, or you might cry out in pain, and that's acting, right? And like you're saying that, and so you don't want someone to misinterpret that as stop, because you actually want that to happen. So in contracts, not only do you spell out the behaviors that you are and are not okay with, sexually and otherwise, but also the types of language or safe words that you might use to stop something that you don't want to do. So underlying all of these types of BDSM behaviors is what people often say the mantra is safe, sane, and consensual.
Well, let me quote something actually that Maureen Dowd quoted. She interviewed a woman who's, a dominant, but the quote is here, and I'll put this back to you, Debbie. Every good dominant knows that the submissive is really the partner in control, which on the face of it doesn't look that way, but does that make sense to you?
It does. It's absolutely the case. And because if you really are doing this in a way that involves open communication and respect and done the way that, you know, we would all say it sort of should be done, then yes, the submissive is in control because they are describing what their boundaries are. Does that always work out that way in real life? No. You know, there are certainly some situations that go wrong. But when done well and when done in this consensual way, that is the case.
Debbie, going back to you, that since you work at the Kinsey Institute and in many ways probably know what really goes on in people's bedrooms, but has sex gotten more kinky?
You know, I think we certainly talk more openly about sort of kink aspects of sex, but one of the great things about the Kinsey Institute is that we're not just a place where research happens, but we have an incredible art and library collection. And so there are images from so many different historical time periods, you know, photographs when photographs became available, but before that, drawings and paintings. And, you know, there are elements of what we now call BDSM throughout history and in many different, you know, cultures. And so, you know, certainly these interests have always existed. They've taken different shape at different times in different places, but it's not new. It's just more often talked about.
Perhaps, Debbie, I can go back to you. And do you see this as breaking taboos and maybe opening the doors to breaking other taboos?
I think it might. You know, and I do think that I do see in the last few years a lot more public conversation about, you know, open relationships. You know, Dan Savage has used the term monogamish to be mostly monogamous, but sometimes, you know, being sexual with other people. So there are different terms that people use. But I do think that that's going to be another taboo that we're going to continue to see broken down. I think there are just so many people that are living their lives and their relationships in some sort of more, you know, interesting, nuanced way rather than just like monogamous or not. And I think we can't help but start to talk about that more and hopefully eventually accept that more.
What do you think, Tracy?
Yeah, I think that increasingly we are recognizing the ways that monogamy can and often does fail. And we're coming up with new and creative ways to address that. And I also think in general that we're becoming much more accepting of non-traditional family formations. And so, you know, gay marriage has become so much more acceptable. The transformation in that arena has been just spectacular. So I think that in general, we're seeing a major transformation in how we, in our openness to, you know, conceiving of different family and romantic formulations.
Do you see this as healthy, Debbie?
I do. I think that anytime we can have cultural conversations around, you know, different ways that people live their romantic lives, their families, their sexual lives, that's a good thing. And I think, you know, this book is certainly part of it. I think we've been breaking taboos for so many years. Sometimes we forget how far we've come, even from just the fact that, you know, women can wear pants to work and not be sent home. And that has to do with sex, and it has to do with gender. And, you know, every generation has different taboos that they get to see sort of broken down, like the Berlin Wall. And I think, you know, having some conversation about power exchange relationships is just one of them for this current generation.
That, again, was my conversation with sex research scientist Debbie Herbenick and Tracy Clark Flory of Salon.com about the literary phenomenon 50 Shades of Grey. The movie adaptation of the book hits theaters today. And that wraps up our Valentine's Day edition of Radio Times in Review. Tell us what you think. Go to WHYY.org. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for listening.